Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast sponsored by BYU International Cinema. I'm Chip Oskerson, co-director of International Cinema, coming to you from Paris and joined today by Mark Yamada, the other co-director who is in Provo. How are you doing, Mark?
Great to be here.
We'll be discussing the films from the 9th to the 12th of October today. And among those films are the film Wings, a Russian film, The Load, Unknown Soldier, and They Shall Not Grow Old. It was a week filled with war and memories of war. That was the title of our theme. And we'll be talking about those films first and talking about them as if you've seen them. So we won't be giving any spoiler alerts. A little bit later on in the program, we'll be previewing the films for the coming week. And for those, we promise no spoilers. And you can use the program notes that we provide to jump ahead if you need to. Let's get started, Mark. What were some of the things that people were talking about around the Kimball Tower this week? Any of the films that particularly stood out?
You know, it was, it was war, right? So we had four films that were a little heavier in theme. Probably the film that really stood out for the week was They Shall Not Grow Old. You know, a really great film and has gotten a lot of buzz and a lot of people are interested in it. So that one is one that I think a lot of people wanted to come out and see. Unknown Soldier is another one that I think from the previews, it looked like it would be a kind of more an action-packed kind of war film. So I think people were interested in that as well. So four really great films that deal with how we think back on war and remember war.
Yeah, well, we'll kind of weave some of that overall discussion maybe into as we talk about the individual films. Wings is maybe where we can start. This is a film that was made by the director Larisa Shepko in 1966. And she's an interesting director. I'm not, familiar with all of her work. She hasn't made that many films. She was a very promising filmmaker and her life was cut short at the age of 40, as we mentioned in our preview last week. And that's kind of a shame. But she fits into a genre, if you want to call it a genre, a movement maybe in mid-century Russian filmmaking after Stalin's death that goes back and revisits the issue of war in different kinds of ways. This film, it's when we put films like this on the schedule, it's not because we know that it's going to get the biggest crowds. It's they're historical. People don't always, know about them. But I think that they're valuable in that they show a different kind of filmmaking. And in this case, the plot is not heavily narrative driven. That is, there's not a kind of a single thing driving through the whole, a particular problem that has to be solved by the film, but maybe rather something that is more akin to a road movie insofar that it's kind of episodic, right? And you're getting a slice of the life, of this woman who is dealing with life after war and kind of the mundaneness of it all. And that can be a kind of interesting film to make, but a hard film to make too, right? That how do you, how do you keep the audience engaged and involved when you are dealing with things that are not action-packed, right?
Sure.
For me, what's the most interesting was the way that it wove together these kinds of experiences and combined it with some really wonderful photography. And there's a nice sense of pacing, I think, for the film. And I really love the aerial, the way that the aerial shots combine together with the, kind of the claustrophobic interiors to give a sense of this tension visually. It keeps you going even when there's not kind of a strong central problem that has to be solved or will be solved by the, by the end of the film.
Right.
A lot of ways it gets us ready for, people like Tarkovsky and other Soviet filmmakers from the mid 20th century that are likewise taking a different approach to filmmaking. They're taking a step back from the kind of propaganda that was particularly common during the Stalin days. And they're being a little bit more critical, not critical of the regime per se, but, they're looking at some of the problems that come with war and with the way that things have been represented, that it's more psychological, looking at the cost of war really, to the individual person, following war. That's for all these reasons, this is why I thought this was a film, very definitely worth showing. In a lot of ways, The Load is doing a similar thing in that we're dealing with with trauma after the war, right? That this is made about a, you know, particularly horrible episode in the, you know, the Balkans history. Yeah. And it's, you can't read this film without, you know, thinking specifically about the way that the events that took place there really linger, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's set in the late 90s, you know, it's from last year, but so in some ways you're dealing with the memory that's lasted 20 years after the event, but also kind of going back to the time and the way that people are dealing with this event. And it's, you know, the backdrop is of course the Bosnian War, and you have, you know, on the backdrop, you have bombing, and it kind of a little bit like Wings. I mean, The Load is happening during the war, but you don't really see a lot of the war itself. You don't see a lot of the violence. I think that's the reason, that's kind of maybe the point of the film in some ways, that you're, you know, following this truck driver who's transporting a load from Kosovo to Belgrade. And, you know, this is a little bit of a spoiler alert, but, you know, the whole time we're kind of wondering what could be inside this load. And then we find out that it's something that's horrific, and it's bodies that have been killed, and he's transporting them to be buried and to be basically hidden from sight. And I think what is really great about this film is that it's such a great sense of visual storytelling and using kind of these visual allegories of the way in which we are complicit in some ways with things that happen, the atrocities that happen. At the same time, we don't really want to see them, or we're kind of kept in the dark a little bit. The first time that he actually kind of recognizes that what he was carrying, he's looking out the window and seeing soldiers unload the cargo, these human bodies to be buried, and looks away. And then you have kind of this, you know, this referencing of bodies. You have a lot of metonyms. You have this kind of, there's a great scene in the film where the trunk of a car opens up and these balloons fly out. And it's a really great kind of foreshadowing of you know, later on when a trunk's going to be open and bodies are going to be pulled out. You have one scene where he's cleaning out the, you know, the truck after the bodies are unloaded, and you know, all that remains are this, you know, this pungent odor, some of the remnants of the people, a marble rolls down out of the truck, reminding us that, you know, the younger victims of this atrocity. And so really interesting way in which it kind of comments on our willful attempt to kind of keep ourselves from looking directly at atrocity, especially particularly the citizens at this time, and the way in which they were, you know, this was going on while they were kind of leading their lives and going about their lives. So really powerful film, I thought.
Well, and there's that, you know, kind of great tension in the film too, where he's just, you know, like you said, he's just trying to get by, right? This is a right. job that he, you know, it's not that he holds any particular animosity, you know, towards any person, but you find yourself in the middle of this. And I love the title too. Oh, I mean, the idea of carrying a load around, right? And that, you know, Serbians, Bosnians, Croatians, you know, they all carry this load, this memory of these things that happened, that, you know, maybe they didn't have a direct role in, but that happened around them and to their neighbors, and that they directly or indirectly find themselves, you know, unwillingly complicit right. in different kinds of things that even things that they didn't necessarily agree with or agree to be a part of. It is a load. And how do you take care of that load eventually? How does a society move on
right.
from that?
Right. Yeah. And even though he, you know, he knows, he doesn't want to know fully what's going on, but he knows, and at the same time has to go on with things. There's a really great shot at the end where you see a shot from kind of an upstairs window, and looking down on the scene of the man kind of loading up the truck again, and you have people kind of going about their lives, and just the way in which this has kind of become part of every day, and yet still is, like you said, a load, a psychological load, a kind of traumatic load that people carry. So yeah, really great film.
An interesting contrast to that, I think, is The Unknown Soldier, insofar that this is talking about the continuation war, this is representing the continuation war between Finland and the Soviet Union during the middle of World War II. And just a quick recap for those who aren't familiar, that Finland was attacked by the Soviet Union first in the Winter War, which preceded the continuation war, and were kind of left by themselves. They eventually allied with Germany. They were technically one of the Axis powers, because they found themselves fighting the Soviet Union. And it was a really bloody and difficult conflict. Finland had only been a nation for a couple decades at that point. They'd already fought a pretty bloody civil war themselves. And so this war for three, well, in the Winter War, there's kind of territories exchanged, but during the continuation war, the Finns actually push the Soviets all the way out of East Karelia, which had been taken, you know, previously, mm-hmm. And then were eventually driven back by the Soviet forces. And this has been an important chapter of for, you know, the opposite reason of the load, right? Because this is a heroic moment for Finland. It stands up against one of the world's superpowers and right. is able to hold out for, you know, for 3 years. And there's a way in which war can become very glorified in that kind of thing, the violence of war, even that it's about being heroes and about falling in line and being part of the nation. And something that the novel and this film, I think, both do, the novel upon which the film is based, which came out in the 50s already, was it wanted to turn that narrative a little bit on its head. And to do that, it looks at a particular group, a machine gunner corps, through 3 years of the war. And the, you know, as people are kind of, you know, killed and different things happen to, you know, to this group, it's a little bit Band of Brothers-ish in that respect. But the main focus of looking at the individuals is to demythologize the war and to remind that, you know, that war is hell, right? It's a really difficult, it's a difficult kind of thing that leaves lasting scars and there's a lasting price for people, particularly those directly involved, that they're going to continue to pay. So it wasn't entirely flattering. And I thought that it was interesting that this film, it starts off very kind of rah-rah Finland. and at a certain point when I was watching, I'm like, okay, this is a little bit overly simplified for me, but that was just about the point in the film for me where it began to turn. And what you get is, instead of these kind of heroic portraits of individuals who just kind of fall into line and do whatever they're told to get the job done, you have the problem of all these individuals that are needing to work together, sometimes better than others, to, you know, to accomplish a task, and they're partially successful in that task and they're partially not. They're flawed characters. They're not perfect. And by the end of the film, I felt that initial impression that I had from the first part had been, you know, supplanted by a more nuanced look at the, you know, the difficulties of all of this. The director made the comment, and I think that this was interesting, that about the novel upon which he was basing the film, that he said, quote, "I think his," meaning the author's, Venolina's, "original idea was to show the events so that they would also act as a warning," right? So he reads the novel as kind of a pacifist manifesto of sorts. And so you get this is played out in the style of the film. And if you think about the battle scenes in this film, they're not quite the typical Hollywood fare. I saw just recently, I was watching a Hollywood blockbuster, and it was just kind of ridiculous, right? The way that these soldiers were superheroes, that they, you know, bullets couldn't affect them, and they just kind of walked in, and one, you know, one of the protagonists takes out all of the, you know, all of the enemies by himself kind of thing. That's not what you get here, right? I mean, there's definitely some heroic actions, but they're very vulnerable, and you never get an overview of the battle. There's always something a little bit disorienting. I think the director's trying to put us in the place of these soldiers, not quite to the extent that a film like Saving Private Ryan does, but you get a lot of low angle shots. You get a lot of kind of confusion with kind of continuity. Isn't real clear where we are all the time in the battle. It's not about the epic. It's not about the grand overarching per se, but more about how the individual stories all feed in and contribute to this, you know, this larger thing.
Right.
They Shall Not Grow Old. This is another one about remembering war and the price of war. I'm glad that it attracted, you know, good attention. This is the film that I wish we had had last year when we were commemorating the end of World War I in a lot of ways. It wasn't available to us.
Right. Yeah, no, as everyone knows, it's Peter Jackson's restoration of World War I footage. I saw this film actually I probably saw an early cut of the film at the Hong Kong Film Festival. And there was a representative from the archives who came and spoke to us and talked about the restoration process, talked about Peter Jackson and his work. Apparently they gave him about 100 hours of footage, and he only used, you know, a couple hours, but apparently restored all of the footage for the archive as kind of a service. Something that really struck me, and I think I was with you, I think you mentioned this, the idea that in some ways is going to seem kind of fake to see this kind of colorization of this footage. And he does a good job, I think, the representative of the archive did a good job about talking about how, in some ways, colorization can lead to kind of this kind of fake animated feel. But what something that I, you know, when I first saw this film, leaving the theater, thinking how what a human experience comes from, even though you have this kind of technological mediation, how it can still kind of create a really human experience. And that, you know, when you kind of increase the frame rate and you're adding frames in order to kind of create this natural sense of movement, you're coloring, you're adding sound, and, you know, apparently even hiring voice forensic lip readers to be able to kind of figure out what the soldiers are saying and then kind of go back in. And so much going on here, but yet the moment in which the screen stretches and you're able to kind of see the characters take life, it's amazing. And it really makes these people seem more human and more real, like they're real people rather than, you know, just this black and white characters from footage from, you know, that we're usually used to seeing kind of history from this time. So really amazing way in which technology allows for that kind of human experience to come out.
Yeah, I think that it's, I mean, there's, I could definitely see how this could be abused in a lot of ways, but I didn't get that feeling when I was watching it. It really did make them more human to me.
There are a few moments where it seems unnatural, or, you know, I mean, I think our speaker on last Wednesday was talking a little bit about the way in which, you know, it's hard to approximate skin color, right? And everyone has different skin tones. Even if you are, you know, Caucasian, your tone is going to be a little bit different. And so they had to do all those kinds of things. And there are times where it does seem like you can kind of tell that there is this kind of layer of color that's being artificially added to it. But there are other times where it just seems like real life and the voices are there. And I think what was really interesting about this, the way in which they would research the history of maybe particular troops and particular soldiers and find their background and then find people from those locations and have them do the dialogue and the voiceovers and things. And so really interesting way in which, you know, in some ways the past is kind of being constructed in the present to a certain extent, but also really kind of brought back through technology.
One thing that I thought about with the film that came from our screening of the series last fall when we were commemorating the 100th anniversary was one of the problems of representing World War I is that we so often get the British and the American side and not all the other stories that are involved. Of course, the Russians are involved, the Germans are involved, the Turks, the Ottomans, as well as a whole, you know, host of other countries that were affected by this. I mean, I can't really fault Peter Jackson for that. He's working with the archive that he has. And
right.
But that's one thing that I felt would be really interesting to kind of flesh this out and complete the story more is to do something similar with some of these other groups. And that would, you know, another film for another time, perhaps.
Sure.
Well, let's turn to our previews then for the coming week. These are the films that will be showing between the 16th and the 19th of October. The films that we're going to be showing are Embrace of the Serpent by Ciro Guerra, which is in Spanish, German, and about five or six indigenous South American languages. That was made in 2015. The second film is High and Low, Akira Kurosawa, who's a familiar director to IC fans, Japanese film from 1963. The Other Story by Avi Nesher in Hebrew and Arabic from 2018, and Human Flow by Wei Wei Ai, or Ai Wei Wei, as it's better known maybe, which is mainly in English, although there's a lot of languages that are represented from 2017. If we start with Embrace the Serpent, I'm excited about this film. This is one of the films I think I'm most excited about showing at IC this semester. Hmm. When I first saw it, I mean, it's one of those films that really just blew me away. Visually, it's so interesting, and narratively, it's so complex. The basic story is that there's two men, a German, Theo von Martius, in 1909, and then a second, whose name is Evan, from 1940. We get both of these stories. Both of them go down to the Amazon, and they're interested in finding this rare plant, this legendary and rare plant. And in both cases, they contact or led to this Amazonian shaman, last survivor of his tribe, Karamakate. And their stories are parallel and kind of interwoven in a really interesting way. And so the basic idea that I think the film is trying to get at is the coming together of two very different ways of seeing the world, kind of a Western, European, American mindset about what existence is, about what nature is, as well as an indigenous South American perspective. The actor who plays Caramacte, Nibilo Torres, is himself one of the remaining members of his tribe. I think there's only, about a dozen or so of the Acania people that are left. And this is in Colombia, in the Amazonian Colombia. And so there's kind of a personal dimension. And Kiro Guerra, who made the film, he was very sensitive. He made kind of a point about not going down and imposing a story on indigenous people, right? I mean, that in fact is what's right. being critiqued. But really using the story to explore what contact means, he used kind of the indigenous population, both in front and behind the camera. They were involved in the translation, into these different languages. They even gave feedback and reworked drafts of the script where they felt like he didn't, quite get it. There's reports about they performed ritual for spiritual protection and consequently had no accidents or illnesses during the filming. It's not a documentary. It's not that at all, but we're very willfully combining different aspects of different cultures. Guerra, makes a point of saying that the film, and this is in his words, is an imagined Amazon because the real Amazon doesn't fit on one film. So this film's doing sure. a lot of things. We're co-sponsoring this with the Honors Program, who's reading the book 1493, which is a book about the effects of contact between the old and the new world, kind of going both directions. And I think that it's going to, provide a lot of interesting discussion for them. Something that people can watch for as they're watching this, of course, is to follow this theme about what are the differences and what happens when these differences come into contact with each other. The big question is, why did he decide to shoot this in black and white? How would this be different in color to watch this in color? It is, the photography is just really amazing. It really reaches out and grabs you. Seeing this on a big screen is going to be a real treat for people, I think.
Yeah. Beautifully shot.
Yeah. The last thing to think and watch for is, what is the role of dreams? That there's a lot of talk of dreams. The German explorer Theo von Martius makes the comment early on that he's lost the ability to dream. And I think that there's a way that in Western cultures that we continue to place a real high premium on rationality, and that we tend to still today view indigenous cultures as maybe backward in a way, in the way that they understand supernatural or spirituality or whatever you want to call it. I mean, I think especially for our audience that they'll be kind of more sensitive to what the film is trying to get at, in that there's things that can be known and there's things that can't be known by the way that we think we know things, if that makes sense.
Very cryptic.
Yeah, that's right. Tell us a little bit about High and Low. This is a Kurosawa film, fits into our noir series.
Yeah, and we're used to seeing more, period pieces from Kurosawa. I don't know if we've actually shown this film at IC. We might have shown some other films of his that are kind of the noir genre. This is really a classic noir. It takes place in the 60s and is filmed in the 60s. And the 60s were for Japan really kind of what the 50s were for America. I mean, it was a time when, the economy is starting to boom, and you also have a really strong film industry. I mean, really a lot of films are coming out during this time. And this is really a classic. It's really a stylish film about a botched kidnapping that occurs and kind of the fallout from that. And it deals with some of the ethics and big business and a lot of the issues that I think in some ways you'll see with Double Indemnity and some other of the noir that we've been watching up to this point, dealing kind of with socioeconomic issues and relationships. With this film, something to look forward to is really Kurosawa's use of shot composition. He's really, one of his trademarks is using this kind of triangular composition, this deep focus shots where you have characters in the foreground and then some of the background, or two characters in the foreground, one in the background, and there's this really interesting kind of interaction between them. They're all doing different things, and and the way in which they kind of show different sides of the dilemma and different sides of the story and what's going on, and really kind of express a lot. So that's something to really look forward to. It's, you know, the first part of the film, maybe an hour of the film, 45 minutes, is shot indoors as the people involved in this, in the kidnapping, those who are kind of the victims of the kidnapping, are talking about the ransom and all the details that go into it, and really kind of deliberating and really interesting. And then it kind of it takes off, and you begin to kind of see the larger implications of the idea of high and low as kind of this reference to socioeconomic kind of position, and the way in which development in post-war Japan meant success for the country, but also left people behind. So a really kind of interesting look at development this time in post-war Japan.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. Like there might be some connections back to Crazy Rich Asians and shoplifters from earlier in the semester, right?
Sure.
The third film is The Other Story. And this is one of the films, I first saw this at the Palm Springs Film Festival this last January, and was one of the films I was most excited about. There's a couple of the films that we're showing this semester. And this is one that I saw, you know, right away. It's like, okay, we've got to bring this. This is a really interesting, relevant story. The basic plot of the story is that you have several different characters, families in Israel, Arabic and Israeli Jewish. And it's exploring the question of families and the question of extremism from several different angles. And I think that the juxtaposition, there's some characters that I think will be easier for our audience to identify with and others that they won't. But what the film is going to push you to do is to look into the other side's perspective, right? To be in their shoes for a little bit. And that's what I thought. It was really effective storytelling, the way that it weaves all of these stories together in a kind of complex thing. Something to watch for is to watch for the way that the narrative structure of the film works, to put these three things into tension with each other. And you suddenly say, oh, wait a second, I was assuming this, but now having seen this from this perspective, I need to go back and reevaluate some of that. And it asks, you know, questions about, you know, when is it right to put, you know, kind of belief and activism before love and family? You know, where are the limits that these things run? And it gets at this in some unexpected kinds of ways. It doesn't follow the traditional, you know, kind of fault lines that exist in this culture. And then lastly, it really is playing with the idea of melodrama, I think, in an interesting way. It resists melodrama, and it does this by focusing on the individual subjective experiences that both fulfills kind of a melodramatic kind of aspect, that is where you want to see really clear distinction between right and wrong, about what the right choice is, the wrong choice is. But then it diffuses that in some key ways that invite some great questions to come out and to be explored. So I think that this is going to be one that is definitely shouldn't be missed.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Human Flow, our documentary for the week.
Yeah, Human Flow is, you know, beautifully shot film. It's Ai Weiwei, who's activist, artist, filmmaker as well. And it's shot in over 20 countries, and it's shot in a variety of different ways. I mean, there's iPhones, there's drones, there's a variety of different handheld cameras, and really looking at the refugee crisis, but looking at it not just from, I think, maybe kind of this humanistic perspective. I mean, you definitely get that because you're on the ground and you're meeting people, but you almost get when I saw it, as I kind of thought of as kind of like almost a post-humanistic look at not just people, but kind of the larger, as the title suggests, a flow of people, and how they become this kind of larger force, or this flow that's kind of moving across borders, and really kind of looking at the movement from more of a grand scale, and seeing how it's influencing kind of larger cultures and societies and civilizations. And so I think it does a good job of doing both, that of kind of showing you the human story, but also showing you kind of really the way in which these groups of people who are displaced from their homelands, and really what the refugee crisis is, and kind of a macro level.
Right.
But really beautifully shot and beautifully and well edited together to make a really great film that's not really kind of hitting you over the head with politics as much, but really kind of just wants to show you kind of what the implications are, the things that we don't really see sometimes.
That seems like it goes well with a lot of his artwork that in various ways wants to communicate the scale of the problem, right?
Right.
And but he does this a lot of times by the accumulation of individual objects.
Yeah.
So that you get this interesting tension between the individual and, like you're saying, kind of that bigger picture.
Yeah.
All right. Well, these are the films that will be showing this next week. We hope that you'll have a chance to see them. Thank you for joining us today on From the Booth. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program at BYU that gets its support from the BYU College of Humanities. The host and guests of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't officially represent any official position adopted by the university or supporting institutions. As always, we thank our sound engineer, Joseph Hegstrom Pratt, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center and the Humanities College web team for their help. Until next week, we hope that we'll see you in 250 of the Kimball Tower. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks a lot. See you next time.